United States. In which case, the duty must be 20% of the competitor's selling price. So all our competitors needed to do was make a few shoes in the United States, get them declared similar, then price them sky high, and boom. They could send our import duties sky high too. And that's just what they did. One simple, dirty little trick, and they'd have managed to spike our import duties by 40% retroactively. Customs was saying we owed them import duties dating back years to the tune of $25 million. Dirty trick or not, Strasser told me Customs wasn't joking around. We owed them $25 million, and they wanted it. Now. I put my head on my desk. A few years earlier, when my fight had been with Onitsuka, I told myself the problem was rooted in cultural differences. Some part of me, shaped by World War II, wasn't all that surprised to be at odds with a former foe. Now I was in the position of the Japanese, at war with the United States of America, with my own government. This was one conflict I never imagined, and desperately didn't want, and yet I couldn't duck it. Losing meant annihilation. What the government was demanding, $25 million, was very nearly our sales number for all of 1977. And even if we could somehow give them a year's worth of revenue, we couldn't continue to pay import duties that were 40% higher. So there was only one thing to do. I told Strasser with a sigh, we'll have to fight this with everything we've got. I don't know why this crisis hit me harder mentally than all the others. I tried to tell myself over and over, we've been through bad times, we'll get through this. But this one just felt different. I tried to talk to Penny about it, but she said I didn't actually talk. I grunted and stared off. Here comes the wall, she'd say, exasperated and a little frightened. I should have told her. That's what men do when they fight. They put up walls. They pull up the drawbridge. They fill in the moat. But from behind my rising wall, I didn't know how. I lost the ability in 1977 to speak. It was either silence or rage with me. Late at night, after talking on the phone with Strasser or Hayes or Woodell or my father, I couldn't see any way out. I could only see myself folding up this business I'd worked so hard to build. So I'd erupt at the telephone. Instead of hanging up, I'd slam the receiver down, then slam it down again, harder and harder until it shattered. Several times I beat the living tar out of that telephone. After I'd done this three times, maybe four, I noticed the repairman from the telephone company eyeing me. He replaced the phone, checked to make sure there was a dial tone, and as he was packing up his tools, he said very softly, "This is really immature." I nodded. "You're supposed to be a grown-up," he said. I nodded again. If a phone repairman feels the need to chastise you, I told myself, your behavior probably needs modifying. I made promises to myself that day. I vowed that from then on I'd meditate, count backward, run 12 miles a night, whatever it took to keep it together. Keeping it together wasn't the same thing as being a good father. I'd always promised myself that I'd be a better father to my sons than my father had been to me, meaning I'd give them more explicit approval, more attention. But in late 1977, when I evaluated myself honestly, when I looked at how much time I was spending away from the boys, and how distant I was even when I was home, I gave myself low marks. Going strictly by the numbers, I could only say that I was 10% better than my father had been with me. At least I'm a better provider, I told myself, and at least I keep telling them their bedtime stories. Boston, April, 1773. Along with scores of angry colonists, protesting the rise of import duties on their beloved tea, Matthew and Travis History snuck aboard three ships in Boston Harbor and threw all the tea overboard. The minute their eyes were closed, I would sneak out of the room and settle into my recliner and reach for the phone. "Hey, Dad, yeah, how you doing?" "Me, yeah, not so good." Over the last 10 years, this had been my nightcap, my salvation. But now, more than ever, I lived for it. I craved things I could only get from my old man, though I'd have been hard-pressed to name them. Reassurance, affirmation, comfort. On December 9th, 1977, I got them all, in a burst, and then some. Sports, of course, were the cause. The Houston Rockets were playing the Los Angeles Lakers that night. At the start of the second half, Lakers guard Norm Nixon missed a jumper, and his teammate, Kevin Kuhnert, a 7-foot beanpole out of Iowa, fought for the rebound with Houston's Kermit Washington. In the tussle, Washington pulled down Kuhnert's shorts, and Kuhnert retaliated with an elbow. Washington then socked Kuhnert in the head. A fight broke out. As Houston's Rudy Tomjanovich ran over to defend his teammates, Washington turned and threw a devastating haymaker, breaking Tomjanovich's nose and jaw and separating his skull and facial bones from his skin. Tomjanovich fell to the floor as if hit with a shotgun blast. His massive body struck the ground with a sickening smack. The sound echoed throughout the upper reaches of the L.A. Forum, and for several seconds, Tomjanovich lay there, motionless, in an ever-widening puddle of his own blood. I hadn't heard anything about it until I talked to my father that night. He was breathless. I was surprised that he'd watched the game, but everyone in Portland was basketball crazy that year, because our Trailblazers were the defending NBA champs. Still, it wasn't the game per se that had him breathless. After telling me about the fight, he cried, oh, Buck, it was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. Then there was a long pause, and he added, the camera kept zooming in, and you could see quite clearly on Tomjanovich's shoes, the swoosh. They kept zooming in on the swoosh. I'd never heard such pride in my father's voice. Sure, Tomjanovich was in a hospital fighting for his life. And sure, his facial bones were floating around his head, but Buck Knight's logo was in the national spotlight. That might have been the night the swoosh became real to my father, and respectable. He didn't actually use the word proud, but I hung up the phone feeling as if he had. It almost makes this all worthwhile, I told myself. Almost. Sales had been climbing with geometric steadiness year after year ever since the first few hundred pairs I sold out of my Valiant. But as we closed out 1977, sales were going berserk, nearly $70 million. So Penny and I decided to buy a bigger house. It was a strange thing to do in the midst of an apocalyptic fight with the government, but I liked the idea of acting as if things were going to work out. Fortune favors the brave, that sort of thing. I also like the idea of a change of scenery. Maybe, I thought, it will initiate a change of luck. We were sad to leave the old house, of course. Both boys had taken their first steps there, and Matthew had lived for that swimming pool. He was never so at peace as when frolicking in the water. I recall Penny shaking her head and saying, one thing's for certain, that boy will never drown. But both boys were getting so big, they desperately needed more room, and the new place had plenty. It sat on 5 acres, high above Hillsborough, and every room felt spacious and airy. From the first night, we knew we'd found our home. There was even a built-in niche for my recliner. To honor our new home, our new start, I tried to keep a new schedule. Unless I was out of town, I tried to attend all the youth basketball games and youth soccer games and Little League games. I spent whole weekends teaching Matthew to swing a bat, though both of us wondered why. He refused to keep his back foot still. He refused to listen. He argued with me constantly. The ball's moving, he said. Why shouldn't I? Because it's harder to hit that way. There was never a good enough reason for him. Matthew was more than a rebel. He was, I discovered, more than a contrarian. He couldn't abide authority, and he perceived authority lurking in every shadow. Any opposition to his will was oppression, and thus a call to arms. In soccer, for instance, he played like an anarchist. He didn't compete against the opponent so much as against the rules, the structure. If the other team's best player was coming toward him on a breakaway, Matthew would forget the game, forget the ball, and just go for the kid's shins. Down went the kid, out came the parents, and all hell would break loose. During one Matthew-sparked melee, I looked at him and realized he didn't want to be there any more than I did. He didn't like soccer. For that matter, he didn't care for sports. He was playing, and I was watching him play out of some sense of obligation. Over time, his behavior had a suppressive effect on his younger brother. Though Travis was a gifted athlete and loved sports, Matthew had turned him off. One day, little Travis simply retired. He would no longer go out for any teams. I asked him to reconsider, but the only thing he had in common with Matthew, and maybe his father, was a stubborn streak. Of all the negotiations in my life, those with my sons have been the most difficult. On New Year's Eve 1977, I went around my new house, putting out the lights, and I felt a kind of fissure at the core of my existence. My life was about sports, my business was about sports, my bond with my father was about sports, and neither of my two sons wanted anything to do with sports. Like the American selling price, it all seemed so unjust. 1978. Strasser was our five-star general, and I was ready to follow him into any fray, any fusillade. In our battles with Onitsuka, his outrage had comforted and sustained me, and his mind had been a formidable weapon. In this new war with the feds, he was doubly outraged. Good, I thought. He stomped around the offices like a pissed-off Viking, and his stomps were music to my ears. We both knew, however, that rage wasn't going to be enough, nor was Strasser alone. We were taking on the United States of America. We needed a few good men. So Strasser reached out to a young Portland lawyer, a friend of his named Richard Werschkel. I don't remember ever being introduced to Werschkel. I don't remember anyone asking me to meet him or hire him. I just remember suddenly being aware of Werschkel, extremely conscious of his presence all the time. The way you're aware of a big woodpecker in your front yard, or on your head. For the most part, Werschkel's presence was welcome. He had the kind of go-go motor we liked, and the credentials we always looked for. Stanford undergrad, University of Oregon Law. He also had a compelling personality, a presence. Dark, wiry, sarcastic, bespectacled. He possessed an uncommonly deep baritone, several octaves below the voice that spoke to Moses out of the whirlwind. Overall, he gave the impression of a man with a plan, and the plan didn't include surrender or sleep. On the other hand, he also had an eccentric streak. We all did, but Werschkel had what Mom Hatfield might have called a wild hair. There was always something about him that didn't quite fit. For instance, though he was a native Oregonian, he had a baffling East Coast air. Blue blazers, pink shirts, bow ties. Sometimes his accent suggested summers in Newport, rowing for Yale, a string of polo ponies. Surpassing strange in a man who knew his way around the Willamette Valley. And while he could be very witty, even silly, he could change on a dime and become scary serious. Nothing made him more serious than the topic of Nike versus U.S. Customs. Some inside Nike worried about Werschkel's seriousness, fearing it bordered on obsession. Fine by me, I thought. Obsessives were the only ones for the job. The only ones for me. Some questioned his stability. But when it came to stability, I asked, who among us will throw the first stone? Besides, Strasser liked him, and I trusted Strasser. So when Strasser suggested that we promote Werschkel and move him to Washington, D.C., where he'd be closer to the politicians we'd need on our side, I didn't hesitate. Neither, of course, did Werschkel. About the same time we dispatched Werschkel to Washington, I sent Hayes to Exeter to check on things at the factory and to see how Woodell and Johnson were getting along. Also on his agenda was the purchase of something called a rubber mill. Allegedly, it would help us do a better job of dictating the quality of our outer soles and midsoles. Plus, Bowerman wanted it for his experiments, and my policy was still WBW, whatever Bowerman wants. If Bowerman requisitions a Sherman tank, I told Waddell, don't ask questions, just dial the Pentagon. But when Hayes asked Waddell about these rubber mill gizmos and where to find one, Waddell shrugged. Never heard of them. Waddell referred Hayes to GM Pietro, who knew everything worth knowing about rubber mills, of course. And days later, Hayes found himself trekking with GM Pietro into the backwoods of Maine to the little town of Saco and an auction of industrial equipment. Hayes wasn't able to find a rubber mill at the auction, but he did fall in love with the auction site, an old red brick factory on an island in the Saco River. The factory was something out of Stephen King, but that didn't spook Hayes. It spoke to him. I guess it was to be expected that a man with a bulldozer fetish would become enamored of a rusted-out factory. The surprising part was the factory happened to be for sale. Price, $500,000. Hayes offered the factory owner $100,000, and they settled on $200,000. Congratulations, Hayes and Waddell said when they phoned that afternoon. For what? For only slightly more than the cost of a rubber mill, you are the proud owner of a whole damn factory, they said. The heck are you talking about? They filled me in. Like Jack telling his mother about the magic beans, they mumbled when they got to the part about the price, and about the factory needing tens of thousands of dollars in repairs. I could tell they'd been drinking, and later Waddell would confess that after stopping at a huge discount liquor outlet in New Hampshire, Hayes whooped, "At prices like this, a man can't afford not to drink." I rose from my chair and yelled into the phone, "You dummies! What do I need with a non-working factory in Saco, Maine?" "Storage," they said. "And one day it could be a compliment to our factory in Exeter." In my best John McEnroe, I screamed, "You cannot be serious! Don't you dare!" "Too late. We already bought it." Dial tone. I sat down. I didn't even feel mad. I was too upset to be mad. The feds were dunning me for $25 million I didn't have, and my men were running around the country writing checks for hundreds of thousands of dollars more without even asking me. Suddenly I became calm, quasi-comatose. I told myself, who cares? When the government comes in, when they repossess everything, lock, stock, and barrel, let them figure out what to do with a non-working factory in Saco, Maine. Later, Hayes and Waddell called back and said they'd only been kidding about buying the factory. "Pull in your chain," they said. "But you need to buy it. You must." "Okay," I said wearily. "Okay, whatever you dummies think best." We were on track in 1979 for sales of $140 million. Better yet, our quality was rising apace. People in the trade, industry insiders, were writing articles praising us for finally putting out a better shoe than Adidas. Personally, I thought the insiders were late to the party. Other than a few early stumbles, our quality had been tops for years, and we'd never lagged in innovation. Plus, we had Rudy's air soles in the pipeline. Aside from our war with the government, we were in great shape, which seemed like saying, aside from being on death row, life was grand. Another good sign, we kept outgrowing our headquarters. We moved again that year to a 40,000-square-foot building all our own in Beaverton. My private office was sleek and huge, bigger than our entire first headquarters next to the pink bucket. And utterly empty. The interior decorator decided to go minimalist, Japanese, with one touch of the absurd that everyone found hilarious. She thought it would be a hoot to set beside my desk a leather chair shaped like a baseball mitt. "Now," she said, "you can sit there every day and think about your sports things." I sat in the mitt like a foul ball and looked out the window. I should have reveled in that moment, savored the humor and the irony. Getting cut from my high school baseball team had been one of the great hurts of my life. And now I was sitting in a giant mitt in a swank new office presiding over a company that sold sports things to professional baseball players. But instead of cherishing how far we'd come, I saw only how far we had to go. My window looked onto a beautiful stand of pines, and I definitely couldn't see the forest for the trees. I didn't understand what was happening in the moment, but now I do. The years of stress were taking their toll. When you see only problems, you're not seeing clearly. At just the moment I needed to be my sharpest, I was approaching burnout. I opened the final buttface of 1978 with a rah-rah speech, trying to fire up the troops, but especially myself. "Gentlemen," I said, "our industry is made up of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And next year, finally, one of the dwarfs is going to get into Snow White's pants." As if the metaphor needed further explanation, I explained that Adidas was Snow White, and our time, I thundered, is coming. But first we needed to start selling clothes. Aside from the plain numerical fact that Adidas sold more apparel than shoes, apparel gave them a psychological edge. Apparel helped them lure bigger athletes into sweeter endorsement deals. "Look at all we can give you," Adidas would say to an athlete, pointing to their shirts and pants and other gear. And they could say the same thing when they sat down with sporting goods stores. Besides, if we ever resolved our fight with the feds and if we ever wanted to go public, Wall Street wouldn't give us the respect we deserved if we were just a shoe company. We needed to be diverse, which meant developing a solid line of apparel, which meant finding someone darn good to put in charge of it. At the buttface, I announced that someone would be Ron Nelson. "Why him?" Hayes asked. Well, I said, "for starters, he's a CPA. Hayes waved his arms over his head. "Just what we need," he said, "another accountant." He had me there. I did seem to hire nothing but accountants and lawyers. It wasn't that I had some bizarre affection for accountants and lawyers. I just didn't know where else to look for talent. I reminded Hayes, not for the first time, that there's no shoe school, no university of footwear from which we could recruit. We needed to hire people with sharp minds. That was our priority. And accountants and lawyers had at least proved that they could master a difficult subject and pass a big test. Most had also demonstrated basic competence. When you hired an accountant, you knew he or she could count. When you hired a lawyer, you knew he or she could talk. When you hired a marketing expert or product developer, what did you know? Nothing. You couldn't predict what he or she could do, or if he or she could do anything. And the typical business school graduate? He or she didn't want to start out with a bag selling shoes, and they all had zero experience, so you were simply rolling the dice based on how well they did in an interview. We didn't have enough margin for error to roll the dice on anyone. Besides, as accountants went, Nelson was a standout. He'd become a manager in just 5 years, which was ridiculously fast. And he'd been valedictorian at his high school. Alas, we didn't find out until later that he went to high school in eastern Montana. His class had 5 people. On the minus side of the ledger, because he'd become an accountant so fast, Nelson was young. Maybe too young to handle something as big as the launch of an apparel line. But I told myself that his youth wouldn't be a critical factor, because starting an apparel line was relatively easy. After all, there wasn't any technology or physics involved. As Strasser had once quipped, "There's no such thing as air shorts." Then, during one of my meetings with Nelson, right after I'd hired him, I noticed he had absolutely no sense of style. The more I looked him over, up and down, side to side, the more I realized that he might have been the worst dresser I'd ever met, worse than Strasser. Even Nelson's car, I noticed one day in the parking lot, was a hideous shade of brown. When I mentioned this to Nelson, he laughed. He had the nerve to brag that every car he'd ever owned had been the same brown. "I might have made a mistake with Nelson," I confided to Hayes. I was no fashion plate, but I knew how to wear a decent suit. And because my company was launching an apparel line, I now started paying closer attention to what I wore and what those around me wore. On the second front, I was appalled. Bankers and investors, reps from Nisho, and all kinds of people we needed to impress were passing through our new halls. And whenever they saw Strasser in his Hawaiian shirts or Hayes in his bulldozer driving outfits, They did triple takes. Sometimes our eccentricity was funny. A top executive at Foot Locker said, "We think of you guys as gods until we see your cars." But most times it was embarrassing and potentially damaging. Thus, around Thanksgiving 1978, I instituted a strict company dress code. The reaction wasn't terribly enthusiastic. Corporate bullshit, many grumbled. I was mocked. Mostly, I was ignored. To even a casual observer, it became clear that Strasser started dressing worse. When he showed up to work one day in baggy-seated Bermuda shorts, as if he were walking a Geiger counter down the beach, I couldn't stand by. This was rank insubordination. I intercepted him in the halls and called him out. "You need to wear a coat and tie," I said. "We're not a coat and tie company," he shot back. "We are now." He walked away from me. In the coming days, Strasser continued to dress with a studied, confrontational casualness. So I fined him. I instructed the bookkeeper to deduct $75 from Strasser's next paycheck. He threw a fit, of course, and he plotted. Days later, he and Hayes came to work in coats and ties, but preposterous coats and ties. Stripes and plaids, checks with polka dots, all of it rayon and polyester and burlap? They meant it as a farce, but also as a protest, a gesture of civil disobedience, and I was in no mood for two fashion Gandhis staging a dress-in. I disinvited them both from the next buttface. Then I ordered them both to go home and not to come back until they could behave and dress like adults. "And you're fined again," I yelled at Strasser. "Then you're fucked," he yelled back. Just then, at that exact moment, I turned. Coming toward me was Nelson, dressed worse than the lot of them. Polyester bell-bottoms, a pink silk shirt open to his navel. Strasser and Hayes were one thing, but where the heck did this new guy get off protesting my dress code after I'd just hired him? I pointed at the door and sent him home, too. From the horrified look on his face, I realized he wasn't protesting. He was just naturally unstylish. My new head of apparel. I retreated that day to my baseball mitt chair and stared out the window for a long, long time. Sports things. I knew what was coming, and, oh brother, it came. A few weeks later, Nelson stood before us and made his formal presentation of the first ever line of Nike apparel. Beaming with pride, grinning with excitement, he laid all the new clothes on the conference table. Soiled workout shorts, ragged t-shirts, wrinkled hoodies. Each putrid item looked as if it had been donated to or pilfered from a dumpster. The topper? Nelson pulled each item from a dirty brown paper bag, which looked as if it also contained his lunch. At first we were in shock. None of us knew what to say. Finally someone chuckled. Strasser, probably. Then someone haw-hawed. Woodell, maybe. Then the dam burst. Everyone was laughing, rocking back and forth, falling out of their chairs. Nelson saw that he'd goofed, and in a panic he started stuffing the clothes back into the paper bag, which ripped apart, which made everyone laugh harder. I was laughing too, harder than anyone. But at any moment, I felt as if I might start sobbing. Shortly after that day, I transferred Nelson to the newly formed production department, where his considerable accounting talents helped him do a great job. Then I quietly shifted Woodell to apparel. He did his typically flawless job, assembling a line that gained immediate attention and respect in the industry. I asked myself why I didn't just let Woodell do everything, including my job. Maybe he could fly back east and get the feds off my back. Amid all this turmoil, amid all this uncertainty about the future, we needed a morale boost. And we got it at the tail end of 1978, when we finally brought out the Tailwind. Developed in Exeter, made in Japan, the brainchild of M. Frank Rudy was more than a shoe. It was a work of postmodern art. Big, shiny, bright silver filled with Rudy's patented air soles, it featured 12 different product innovations. We hyped it to the heavens with a splashy ad campaign, and tied the launch to the Honolulu Marathon, where many runners would be wearing it. Everyone flew out to Hawaii for the launch, which turned into a drunken bacchanal and a quasi-coronation of Strasser. I was transitioning him from legal to marketing, moving him out of his comfort zone, as I like to do with everyone now and then to prevent them from growing stale. Tailwind was Strasser's first big project, so he felt like Midas. "Nailed it," he kept saying. And who could begrudge him a bit of chest thumping? After its wildly successful debut, Tailwind became a sales monster. Within 10 days, we thought it might have a chance of eclipsing the waffle trainer. Then the reports began to trickle in. Customers were returning the shoe to stores in droves, complaining that the thing was blowing up, falling apart. Autopsies on the returned shoes revealed a fatal design flaw. Bits of metal in the silver paint were rubbing against the shoe's upper, acting like microscopic razors, slicing and shredding the fabric. We issued a recall of sorts and offered full refunds, and half of the first generation of Tailwinds ended up in recycling bins. What began as a morale boost ended up being a body blow to everyone's confidence. Each person reacted in his own way. Hayes drove in frantic circles on a bulldozer. Woodell stayed longer each day at the office. I toggled dazedly between my baseball mitt and my recliner. In time, we all agreed to pretend it was no big deal. We'd learned a valuable lesson. Don't put 12 innovations into one shoe. It asks too much of the shoe, to say nothing of the design team. We reminded each other that there was honor in saying back to the drawing board. We reminded each other of the many waffle irons Bowerman had ruined. "Next year," we all said, "you'll see, next year, the dwarf is going to get Snow White." But Strasser couldn't get past it. He started drinking, showing up late to work. His mode of dress was now the least of my problems. This might have been his first real failure ever, and I'll always remember those dreary winter mornings, seeing him shamble into my office with the latest bad news about his Tailwind. I recognized the signs. He, too, was approaching burnout. The only person who wasn't depressed about the Tailwind was Bowerman. In fact, its catastrophic debut helped pull him out of a slump in which he'd been mired since retiring. How he loved being able to tell me, to tell us all, "Told you so." Our factories in Taiwan and Korea were humming along, and we opened new ones that year in Heckmondwike, England, and Ireland. Industry watchers pointed to our new factories and our roaring sales and said we were unstoppable. Few imagined we were broke, or that our head of marketing was wallowing in a depression, or that our founder and president was sitting in a giant baseball mitt with a long face. The burnout spread around the office like mono, and while we were all burning out, our man in Washington was flaming out. Werschel had done everything we'd asked of him. He'd buttonholed politicians. He'd petitioned, lobbied, pleaded our cause with passion, if not always with sanity. Day after day, he'd run up and down the halls of Congress handing out free pairs of Nikes. Swag with a sight of swoosh. Knowing that representatives were legally bound to report gifts worth more than $35, Werschel always included an invoice for $34.99. But every Paul told Werschel the same thing. "Give me something in writing, son, something I can study. Give me a breakdown of your case." So, Werschel spent months writing a breakdown, and in the process, suffered a breakdown. What was supposed to be a summary, a brief, had ballooned into an exhaustive history, the decline and fall of the Nike empire, which ran to hundreds of pages. It was longer than Proust, longer than Tolstoy, and not a fraction as readable. It even had a title. Without a shred of irony, Werschel called it Werschel on American Selling Price, Volume 1. When you thought about it, when you really thought about it, what really scared you was that Volume 1. I sent Strasser back east to rein in Werschel, check him into a psych ward if necessary. "Just calm the kid down," I said. That first night, they went to a local pub in Georgetown for a cocktail or three, and at the end of the night, Werschel wasn't any calmer. On the contrary, he got up on a table and delivered his stump speech to the patrons. He went full Patrick Henry. "Give me Nike or give me death." The patrons were ready to vote for the latter. Strasser tried to coax Werschkel down off the chair, but Werschkel was just getting warmed up. "Don't you people realize," he shouted, "that freedom is on trial here? Freedom? Did you know that Hitler's father was a customs inspector?" On the plus side, I think Werschkel scared Strasser straight. He seemed like the old Strasser when he returned and told me about Werschkel's mental condition. We had a good laugh, a healing laugh. Then he handed me a copy of Werschkel on American Selling Price, Volume 1. Werschkel had even had it bound in leather. I looked at the title, WASP. How perfect. How Werschkel. "Are you going to read it?" Strasser said. "I'll wait for the movie," I said, plopping it on my desk. I knew right then that I'd have to start flying back to Washington, D.C., take on this fight myself. There was no other way. And maybe it would cure my burnout. Maybe the cure for any burnout, I thought, is just to work harder. 1979. He occupied a teeny office at the Treasury Department, a space about the size of my mother's linen closet. There was barely room for his government-issued gunmetal gray desk, let alone the matching chair for infrequent visitors. He pointed to this chair. "Sit," he said. I sat. I looked around in disbelief. This was the home base of the man who kept sending us those damned bills for $25 million? I looked now at him, this beady-eyed bureaucrat. What creature did he remind me of? Not a worm. No, he was bigger than that. Not a snake. He was less simple than that. Then I had it. Johnson's pet octopus. I recalled Stretch dragging the helpless crab back to its lair. Yes, this bureaucrat was a kraken. A micro-kraken. A bureau-kraken. Smothering these thoughts, burying all my hostility and fear, I screwed a fake smile onto my face and tried in a friendly tone to explain that this whole thing was a giant misunderstanding. Even the Bureau Kraken's colleagues within the Treasury Department sided with our position. I handed him a document. "You have right here," I said, "a memo stating that the American selling price does not apply to Nike shoes. The memo comes from Treasury." The Bureau Kraken said. He looked it over, pushed it back at me. "That's not binding on customs." "Not binding?" I gritted my teeth. "But this whole case," I said, "is nothing but the result of a dirty trick played by our competitors. We're being penalized for our success." "We don't see it that way." "By we, who do you mean?" "The U.S. government." I found it hard to believe this man was speaking for the U.S. government, but I didn't say that. "I find it hard to believe that the U.S. government would want to stifle free enterprise," I said. "That the U.S. government would want to be a party to this kind of deceit and trickery. That the U.S. government, my government, would want to bully a little company in Oregon. Sir, with all respect, I've been all over the world. I've seen corrupt governments in undeveloped countries act this way. I've seen thugs push around businesses with arrogance, with impunity, and I can't believe my own government would behave in such a fashion." The Bureau Kraken said nothing. A faint smirk flickered across his thin lips. It struck me all at once that he was grotesquely unhappy, as all functionaries are. When I started to speak again, his unhappiness manifested itself in a restless, manic energy. He jumped up and paced. Back and forth, he danced behind his desk. Then he sat down. Then he did it again. It wasn't the pacing of a thinker, but the agitation of a caged animal. Three mincing steps left, three halting limps right. Sitting again, he cut me off mid-sentence. He explained that he didn't care what I said or what I thought or whether any of this was fair or American. He made air quotes with his bony fingers. He just wanted his money. His money? I wrapped my arms around myself. Ever since the onset of burnout, this old habit was becoming more pronounced. I often looked in 1979 as if I were trying to keep myself from flying apart, trying to keep my contents from spilling out. I wanted to make another point to rebut something the Bureau Kraken had just said, but I didn't trust myself to speak. I feared that my limbs might go flailing, that I might begin screaming, that I might beat the hell out of his telephone. We made quite a pair, him with his frantic pacing, me with my frenzied self-hugging. It became clear that we were at an impasse. I had to do something. So I commenced kissing up. I told the Bureau Kraken that I respected his position. He had a job to do. It was a very important job. It must not be easy enforcing burdensome fees, dealing with complaints all the time. I looked around his office cell as if to sympathize. However, I said, if Nike was forced to pay this exorbitant sum of money, the straight truth was it would put us out of business. So, he said. So, I said. Yeah, he said. So what? Mr. Knight, it's my responsibility to collect import duties for the U.S. Treasury. For me, that's as far as it goes. Whatever happens, happens. I hugged myself so tight I must have looked as if I was wearing an invisible straitjacket. Then I released myself, stood. Gingerly, I picked up my briefcase. I told the Bureau Kraken that I wasn't going to accept his decision, and I wasn't going to give up. If necessary, I would visit every congressman and senator and privately plead my case. I suddenly had the greatest sympathy for Werschkel. No wonder he'd come unhinged. Don't you know that Hitler's father was a customs inspector? Do what you gotta do, the Bureau Kraken said. Good day. He turned back to his files. He checked his watch. Getting close to 5. Not much time before the workday ended to ruin someone else's life. I began more or less commuting to Washington. Every month I'd meet with politicians, lobbyists, consultants, bureaucrats, anyone who might help. I immersed myself in that strange political underworld and read everything I could about customs. I even skimmed WASP, Volume 1. Nothing was working. Late in the summer of 1979, Werschkel got me an appointment with one of Oregon's senators, Mark O. Hatfield. Well-respected, well-connected, Hatfield was chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. With one phone call, he might be able to get the Bureau Kraken's bosses to clear up that $25 million discrepancy. So I spent days preparing, studying for the meeting, and huddled several times with Woodell and Hayes. Hatfield's just got to see it our way, Hayes said. He's respected on both sides of the aisle. St. Mark, some call him. He has no truck with abuse of power. He went toe-to-toe with Nixon on Watergate, and he fought like a tiger to get funding for dams on the Columbia. Sounds like our best shot, Woodell said. Maybe our last shot, I said. The night I arrived in Washington, Werschkel and I had dinner and rehearsed. Like two actors running lines, we went through every possible argument Hatfield might throw at us. Werschkel kept referring to WASP, Volume 1. Sometimes he'd even reference Volume 2. Forget that, I said. Let's just keep it simple. The next morning, we walked slowly up the steps of the U.S. Senate office building, and as I looked up at that magnificent facade, at all the columns and all the shiny marble, and at the big flag overhead, I had to pause. I thought of the Parthenon, the Temple of Nike. I knew that this, too, would be one of the seminal moments of my life. No matter how it turned out, I didn't want to let it pass without embracing it, acknowledging it. So I stared at the columns. I admired the sunlight bouncing off the marble. I stood there for the longest time. You coming? Werschkel said. It was a blazing summer day. My hand, the one gripping my briefcase, was drenched with sweat. My suit was soaked through. I looked as if I'd walked through a rainstorm. How was I going to meet a U.S. senator in this condition? How was I going to shake his hand? How was I going to think straight? We entered Hatfield's outer office, and one of his aides led us into a waiting area, a bullpen. I thought of the births of my two sons. I thought of Penny. I thought of my parents. I thought of Bowerman. I thought of Grella. I thought of Pri. I thought of Kitami. I thought of James the Just. "The senator will see you now," the aide said. She led us into a large, refreshingly cool office. Hatfield came out from behind his desk. He welcomed us collegially as fellow Oregonians and led us to a sitting area by his window. We all sat. Hatfield smiled. Werschkel smiled. I mentioned to Hatfield that we were distantly related. My mother, I believed, was his third cousin. We talked a bit about Roseburg. Then we all cleared our throats and the air conditioner coughed. "Ah, well, Senator," I said. "The reason we've come to see you today," he held up his hand. "I know all about your situation. My staff has read Werschkel on American selling price and briefed me on it. What can I do to help?" I stopped, stunned. I turned to Werschkel, whose face was the color of his pink bow tie. We'd spent so much time rehearsing this negotiation, preparing to convince Hatfield of the rightness of our cause. We weren't ready for the possibility of success. We leaned into each other. In half whispers, we talked about different ways Hatfield might help. Werschkel thought he should write a letter to the President of the United States, or maybe the head of customs. I wanted him to pick up the phone. We couldn't agree. We started to argue. The air conditioner seemed to be laughing at us. Finally, I shushed Werschkel, shushed the air conditioner, turned to Hatfield. "Senator," I said, "we were not prepared for you to be so obliging today. The truth is, we don't know what we want. We'll have to get back to you." I walked out, not looking back to see if Werschkel was coming. I flew back to Oregon in time to preside over two milestones. In downtown Portland, we opened a 3,500-square-foot retail palace, which was instantly mobbed. The lines at the cash registers were endless. People were clamoring to try on everything. I had to jump in and help. For a brief time, I was back in my parents' living room, measuring feet, fitting runners with the perfect shoe. It was a ball, a blast, and a timely reminder of why we were in this. Then we moved offices again. We needed still more space, and we found it, in a 46,000-square-foot building with all the amenities, steam room, library, gym, and more conference rooms than I could count. Signing the lease, I remembered those nights driving around with Waddell, looking for cheap office space. I shook my head and smiled, but I had no sense of victory. "It can all disappear tomorrow," I whispered. We were big. There was no denying it. To make sure we weren't too big for our britches, as Mom Hatfield would have said, we moved the way we'd always moved. All 300 employees came in on the weekend and packed up their belongings into their own cars. We provided pizza and beer, and some of the warehouse guys loaded the heavier stuff into vans, and then we all slowly caravaned down the road. I told the warehouse guys to leave the baseball mitt chair behind. In the fall of 1979, I flew to Washington for a second meeting with the Bureau Kraken. This time he wasn't so feisty. Hatfield had been in touch, as had Oregon's other senator, Bob Packwood, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, which had review authority on Treasury. "I'm sick and tired," said the Bureau Kraken, pointing one of his tentacles at me, "of hearing from your high-placed friends." "Oh, sorry," I said. "That mustn't be any fun. But you'll be hearing from them until this situation is resolved." "Do you realize," he hissed, "that I don't need this job? Do you know that my wife has money? I don't need to work, you know." "Good for you. And her. The sooner you retire," I thought, "the better." But the Bureau Kraken would never retire. In years to come, through Republican and Democratic administrations, he'd remain. On and on, like death and taxes. In fact, one day in the distant future, he'd be among the small coterie of bureaucrats to give the disastrous green light that would send federal agents storming the compound at Waco. With the bureau cracking rattled, I was momentarily able to turn my attention back to our other existential threat, production. The same conditions that brought down Japan, fluctuating currency, rising labor costs, government instability, were beginning to coalesce in Taiwan and Korea. The time had come yet again to seek new factories, new countries. The time had come to think of China. The question wasn't how to get into China. One shoe company or another was going to get in eventually, and then all the others would follow. The question was how to get in first. The first to get in would have a competitive advantage that could last decades, not only in China's production sector, but in its markets and with its political leaders. What a coup that would be. In our first meetings on the subject of China, we'd always say, 1 billion people, 2 billion feet. We had one bona fide China expert on our team, Chuck. Besides having worked alongside Henry Kissinger, he sat on the board of the Allen Group, an auto parts manufacturer with designs on the Chinese market. Its CEO was Walter Kissinger, Henry's brother. Chuck told us that Allen, in its exhaustive research into China, had discovered a very impressive China hand named David Chang. Chuck knew China, and he knew people who knew China, but no one knew China like David Chang. Put it this way, Chuck said. When Walter Kissinger wanted to get into China and couldn't, he didn't call Henry, he called Chang. I lunged for the phone. The Chang dynasty at Nike didn't start well. For starters, he was preppy. I thought Werschel was preppy until I met Chang. Blue blazer, gold buttons, heavily starched gingham shirt, regimental necktie. And he wore it all effortlessly, shamelessly. He was the Paisley-hearted love child of Ralph Lauren and Laura Ashley. I took him around the office, introduced him to everyone, and he showed a remarkable talent for saying the absolute wrong thing. He met Hayes, who was 330 pounds, and Strasser, who was 320, and Jim Manns, our new CFO, who was a mounds bar away from 350. Chang made a crack about our half-ton of upper management. So much heft, he said, at an athletic company? No one laughed. Maybe it's your delivery, I told him, hurrying him along. We went down the hall and bumped into Waddell, whom I'd recently called back from the East Coast. Chang reached down, shook Waddell's hand. Skiing accident, he said. What? Waddell said. When you getting out of that chair, Chang asked. Never, you dumb shit. I sighed. Well, I told Chang, there's nowhere to go from here but up. 1980. We all gathered in the conference room and Chang gave us his bio. He was born in Shanghai and raised in opulence. His grandfather was the third largest soy sauce manufacturer in northern China, and his father had been the third highest ranking member of the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. When Chang was a teenager, however, the revolution came. The Changs fled to the United States, to Los Angeles, where Chang attended Hollywood High. He often thought he'd go back, and his parents did also. They kept in close touch with friends and family in China, and his mother remained extremely close with Sun Qingling, the godmother of the revolution. In the meantime, Chang attended Princeton and studied architecture and moved to New York. He landed a job at a good architectural firm where he worked on the Levittown project. Then he set up his own firm. He was making decent money, doing good work, but bored stiff. He wasn't having any fun, and he didn't feel he was accomplishing anything real. One day a Princeton friend complained about being unable to get a visa for Shanghai. Chang helped his friend get the visa and helped him set up appointments with business contacts and found that he enjoyed it. Being an emissary, a go-between, was a better use of his time and talents. Even with his help, Chang cautioned, getting into China was extremely difficult. The process was laborious. You can't just apply for permission to visit China, he said. You have to formally request that the Chinese government invite you bureaucracy doesn't begin to describe it. I closed my eyes and pictured somewhere on the other side of the world a Chinese version of the Bureau Kraken. I also thought of the ex-GIs who'd explained Japanese business practices to me when I was 24. I followed their advice to the letter and never regretted it. So under Chang's direction, we put together a written presentation. It was long. It was almost as long as Warshkoll on American Selling Price, Volume 1. We, too, had it bound. Often we asked each other, is anyone actually going to read this thing? Oh, well, we said, this is how Chang says it's done. We sent it off to Beijing without hope. At the first butt-face of 1980, I announced that, though we'd gained the upper hand with the feds, it might go on forever if we didn't do something bold, something outrageous. I've given this a lot of thought, I said, and I think what we need to do is American Selling Price ourselves. The butt-faces laughed. Then they stopped laughing and looked at each other. We spent the rest of the weekend kicking it around. Was it possible? Nah, it couldn't be. Could we? No way, but maybe? We decided to give it a try. We launched a new shoe, a running shoe with nylon uppers, and called it One Line. It was a knockoff, dirt cheap, with a simple logo, and we manufactured it in Sako at Hayes Ancient Factory. We priced it low, just above cost. Now customs officials would have to use this shoe as a new reference point in deciding our import duty. That was the jab. That was just to get their attention. Then we threw the left hook. We produced a TV commercial telling the story of a little company in Oregon fighting the big bad government. It opened on a runner doing his lonely road work as a deep voice extolled the ideals of patriotism, liberty, the American way, and fighting tyranny. It got people pretty fired up. Then we threw the haymaker. On February 29th, 1980, we filed a $25 million antitrust suit in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, alleging that our competitors and assorted rubber companies, through underhanded business practices, had conspired to take us out. We sat back, waited. We knew it wouldn't take long, and indeed it didn't. The Bureau Kraken cracked up. He threatened to go nuclear, whatever that meant. It didn't matter. He didn't matter. His bosses and his bosses' bosses didn't want this fight anymore. Our competitors and their accomplices in the government realized that they'd underestimated our will. Immediately, they initiated settlement talks. Day in, day out, our lawyers would phone. From some government office, some blue-chip law firm, some conference room on the East Coast meeting with the other side, they'd tell me the latest settlement offer being floated, and I'd reject it out of hand. One day, the lawyer said we could settle the whole thing with no fuss, no courtroom drama, for the tidy sum of $20 million. Not a chance, I said. Another day they phoned and said we could settle for $15 million. Don't make me laugh, I said. As the number crept lower, I had several heated conversations with Hayes and Strasser and my father. They wanted me to settle, be done with this. What's your ideal number, they'd ask. Zero, I'd say. I didn't want to pay one penny. Even one penny would be unfair. But Jaqua and Cousin Hauser and Chuck, who were all consulting on the case, sat me down one day and explained that the government needed something to save face. They couldn't walk away from this fight with nothing. As negotiations ground to a halt, I met one-on-one with Chuck. He reminded me that until this fight was behind us, we couldn't think about going public. And if we didn't go public, we continued to risk losing everything. I became petulant. I moaned about fairness. I talked about holding out. I said maybe I didn't want to go public, ever. Yet again, I expressed my fear that going public would change Nike, ruin it by turning over control to others. What would happen to the culture of Oregon Track, for instance, if it was subject to shareholder votes or corporate raider demands? We'd gotten a little taste of that scenario with the small group of debenture holders. Scaling up and letting in thousands of shareholders, it would be 1,000 times worse. and I couldn't bear the thought of one titan buying up shares, becoming a behemoth on the board. "I don't want to lose control," I said to Chuck. "That's my greatest fear." "Well, there might be a way to go public without losing any control," he said. "What?"